to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Welcome, everybody. I'm going to present a biography of Bill Wilson's sponsor, Ebbie T., and I'm going to cover facts about him that are not well known or have faded from memory or have been mistakenly recorded. I'll discuss Ebbie's family and upbringing in Albany, New York, and his connection with Bill W. and his wife Lois in Vermont, and I'll cover Ebbie's descent into chronic alcoholism, his happy and sober times in Texas, and lastly, his legacy to AA. Be nice if we could get some quiet out there. The big book chapter, Bill's Story, and the books AA Comes of Age and Pass It On, partly describe Ebbie's role in AA history. The book Ebbie, the Man Who Sponsored Bill W. by the late Mel B., is the most detailed and complete biography of Ebbie's life from cradle to grave. Mel had a hand in writing Pass It On, so there is common information in both books. Mel also obtained permission from Ebbie's family members to allow his last name to be published. We'll begin with Ebbie's family history. His earliest American ancestor was the Reverend Thomas Thatcher, who at age 15 settled in America in 1635. He matured into a brilliant scholar, linguist, and clergyman, and also one of the earliest physicians in America. In 1677, he authored the first American publication on a medical subject regarding the treatment of smallpox and measles, which caused devastating lethal epidemics at the time. The Thatchers were upper class, accomplished, civic-minded, and generous. From the mid-1800s on, they were a business and political dynasty in Albany, New York, the state's capital city. Ebbie's grandfather, uncle, and older brother were popular Democratic Party mayors of Albany. Patriarch George Hornell Sr. served 4 terms. Ebbie's uncle, John Boyd, served 2 terms. And his older brother, John Boyd II, served 7 terms. Ebbie's grandfather was born in 1818. He was raised in abject poverty, but became a classic example of a self-made man. He worked his way through college and became a wealthy and prominent business and political figure. He and his wife Ursula Jane Boyd were married in 1843. Their first child, a daughter, died in childhood, and they had 2 sons, John Boyd, born in 1847, and Ebbie's father, George Hornell Jr., born in 1851. There's a bit of a skeleton in the George H. Sr. closet. After his first wife, Ursula, died in 1874, he married Eliza Toomey, a former house servant who took the name Elizabeth Thatcher. They had 2 children, both of whom were born while George H. Sr. was still married to his first wife. George H. Sr. came to Albany in 1849 and established a foundry business. In 1852, he began manufacturing railroad car wheels and profited considerably through a friendship with Albany railroad tycoon Erastus Corning, who was the founder of the New York Central Railroad. Ebbie's uncle, John Boyd, and his wife, Emma Treadwell, were married in 1872 and were devoted to one another. They didn't have any children. Their summer residence was in Altamont, New York, near the scenic Helderberg Escarpment. They were so fond of the region that they purchased large plots of land with the intention of preserving its natural beauty for eventual public use. The land holdings were bequeathed to New York State as the John Boyd Thatcher State Park. Today, it encompasses over 2,000 acres. In 1890, John Boyd was appointed chairman of the Executive Committee on Awards at the World Columbian Exposition, also called the Chicago World's Fair. As a bit of trivia, John McCannon, his steel-cut Irish oatmeal, won an award at the exhibit, and to this day, cans of the oatmeal show an image of the award medal and the approval name of John Boyd Thatcher. John Boyd was a true Renaissance man. He excelled as a philanthropist, patron of the arts, accomplished historian, author, scholar, and collector of rare items of Americana. He wrote books on Shakespeare, the voyages of John Cabot, and on the life and explorations of Christopher Columbus. He also possessed the skeletal remains of Columbus. The John Boyd Thatcher collection of over 5,000 items donated to the Library of Congress includes over 500 rare manuscripts written prior to 1500. There is also an autograph collection of over 25,000 signatures, and it's one of the most valuable and extensive collections in the world, including a complete set of the original signers of the Declaration of Independence. Ebbie's father, George Hennell Jr., and mother Emma had seven children. A daughter, Emma, and a son, Roland, died in childhood. Pa T, as the children called him, had a limited interest in politics, and he focused on managing the family business. He assumed sole proprietorship on the death of his brother and changed the nature of the foundry business to manufacturing ship propellers. Ebbie, the youngest of five siblings, was born on April 29, 1896. His full name is Edwin Throckmorton Thatcher. It's not clear how he got the nickname Ebbie, but his father called him Ed. His four brothers were oldest to youngest, George, John Boyd II, Thomas, and Kennell. Ebbie's grandfather, father, and three brothers were very heavy drinkers, but none appeared to be alcoholic. Ebbie grew up in a mansion staffed with several servants, and he wanted for nothing and was given everything. The Thatcher children were sent to exclusive private schools. Like his brothers and father, Ebbie attended Albany Academy, which was then an all-boys school for the affluent and privileged. Unlike his father and brothers, Ebbie was a poor student and of limited accomplishment. The Thatcher children were also given the best of summer vacations in Manchester, Vermont, which catered to wealthy vacationers with elaborate summer homes in the area. Their elaborate homes were called cottages, and the locals called the vacationers the summer people. Among them were the Thatcher family and the Burnham family of Bill's future wife, Lois. Beginning in 1898, both families vacationed in Manchester for 5 to 6 months each year, together with several servants. Over repeated summer vacations, the two families became very close social friends. In his writings, Bill W. typically described Ebbie as, quote, his old school friend and drinking companion. They spent part of a high school year together, which Bill consistently portrayed as a happy time. In his memorial for Ebbie, he wrote, quote, there were recollections of those joyous days in a Vermont boarding school. As we'll see in a few slides, those days were anything but joyous. Through no fault of Ebbie, it had to be the worst experience of Bill's teenage years. Bill usually depicted their drinking companionship with the single case of a drunken airplane flight from Albany to Manchester. Ebbie later made a surprising revelation about this experience. We'll first cover Bill and Ebbie as old school friends. Bill attended primary school in Rutland and East Dorset, Vermont, and in 1909, at age 14, he was enrolled in Burr and Burton Seminary for his secondary education. He boarded there on weekdays and returned home to East Dorset on weekends. The school today is called Burr and Burton Academy. This is an example of a 1910 and a 1911 Burr and Burton class directory. It shows Bill and his high school sweetheart, Bertha Bamford, listed in the sophomore class. Bill and Ebbie reputedly first met in the summer of 1911, stemming from Bill's local fame as a star pitcher for the Manchester baseball team. At the time, Bill was close friends with Ebbie's brother, Ken, and Ebbie's closest boyhood friend was Lois's brother, Rogers. Eventually, Rogers and Bill became both close friends and brothers-in-law. Rogers introduced Bill to Lois in 1913, and he served as best man at their wedding in 1918. Ebbie's poor academic performance greatly disappointed his parents while he was at Albany Academy. In 1912, they enrolled him in Burr and Burton as a junior and had him room and board with a Manchester, Vermont minister. Bill W. was in the senior class. Bill's first love, Bertha Bamford, was the most popular girl in school and daughter of the rector of Manchester's Zion Episcopal Church. She and Bill were deeply infatuated with each other and seemed the ideal pair. Her family welcomed Bill into their home, and they appeared destined to be married. In the autumn of 1912, Bill seemed to be on top of the world. At Burr and Burton, he was president of the senior class, first violin in the school orchestra, star football player, and star pitcher and captain of the baseball team. He put so much physical effort into becoming a number one baseball pitcher that his pitching arm became deformed at the elbow. He was also self-taught on the violin. All this came to a painful and tragic end on November 19, 1912, in New York City, where Bertha died from an internal hemorrhage after a surgery. Bill learned about her death at school the following day, and it was devastating. He began a 3-year episode of morbid clinical depression that severely affected his health and performance at school and home. Following Bertha's death, Bill failed nearly every mid-year exam. School officials sent for his mother, Emily, who was a practicing physician in Boston. It was decided that Bill would probably do better if he lived with her. He dropped out of Burr and Burton in the spring of 1913 and relocated to Boston. In total, he and Ebby spent around 6 months together in high school. That summer, Bill returned to Burr and Burton and managed to pass the senior exams. He was awarded a diploma and graduated. Ebby returned to Albany Academy in the autumn of 1913, and because of his failing grades at Burr and Burton, he was held back to repeat his junior year. He began drinking while still in high school, and it created problems. In 1915, his father was notified by school officials that there was little more they could do for Ebby. He dropped out without graduating and never returned to school again. His father put him to work at the family foundry business, where he was employed until 1922. From around this point on, he began a downward spiral to chronic alcoholism. Finally, a bright spot emerged for Bill. A romance blossomed between him and Lois during the summer of 1914. In the fall of 1915, they became secretly engaged. After an extended absence, Bill also re-entered Norwich University in the fall of 1915. And in May 1917, the Norwich cadets were called into active service during World War I. That summer, Bill had his first drink at age 22, and he began his downward spiral to chronic alcoholism. In retrospect, Bill and Ebby's time together at Burr and Burton in 1912 and the 2 years that followed were anything but joyous times, as Bill later described them. As noted earlier, Bill commonly called Ebby his, quote, drinking companion, characterized by an outrageous airplane adventure. They each have differing recollections of the incident, as well as the amount and length of time they actually spent drinking together. The airplane flight was from Albany to a new airport at the luxurious Equinox House Hotel in Manchester. It is briefly noted in Bill's story in the Big Book and described in more detail in the book Pass It On. According to Bill's recollections, while on a business trip, he stopped off in Albany to look up Ebby for a night of drinking. They drunkenly decided to charter a flight to the new airport to be the first to land there and make local aviation history. Prior to takeoff, Bill notified Mrs. George Orvis, owner of the Equinox Hotel and Airport. When the plane landed, a band and welcoming committee headed by Mrs. Orvis were there to greet them. Bill claims all aboard the plane were blind drunk, including the pilot. He is cited in Pass It On that, quote, "We somehow slid out of the cockpit and fell on the ground." Such was the history-making episode of the first airplane ever to light at Manchester, Vermont. Ebby claims that only he and Bill were drunk during the flight, and when they landed, they quickly took refuge in one of the airplane hangars. Obviously, the incident was not going to be given any publicity to spare Mrs. Orvis of any further embarrassment. The next day, a very distressed Bill went on a crying jag and wrote an apology to Mrs. Orvis and her son. The episode is also recorded in a spring 2004 Stepping Stone News article, which cites an archived audio recording and a letter of apology written by Bill. Lois later appended an explanatory note to the letter and dated it as 1929 with a question mark in parentheses. It read, quote, "Apology to Franklin and Mrs. Orvis for Bill and Ebby's arrival by plane at the new airfield, having first wired the Orvises of their arrival and falling on their faces dead drunk when trying to alight." Bill claims the date of the flight to be early 1929, and Ebby claims it was after his father's death in May 29. The reference to the year 1929 by Lois, Bill, and Ebby appear to be an error based on newspaper reports. The Manchester Journal and Brooklyn Daily Eagle reported that the airport opened on June 23, 1928, with an inaugural flight from Boston to Manchester. For Bill and Ebbie's flight to qualify as the first to land there, it had to be attempted prior to this date. There is yet another contradiction of memories. Both Bill and his wife Lois claim that he and Ebbie got drunk together whenever Bill was in Albany on business. It didn't happen frequently, but it did happen. Ebbie asserts that he had not seen Bill for 5 years prior to the airplane episode, and that they never had a drink or got drunk together before or after that. Ebbie persistently states in audio recordings that the airplane incident was the first and only time he and Bill drank together and got drunk together. They rarely saw one another over a 10-year span, and then it was only during summers in Vermont. This has been documented in Pass It On since 1984, and by Mel B. in his biography of Ebbie since 1998, and by Mike F. in his book of transcribed recordings published in 2012. Ebbie's recordings state that after the incident, he did not see Bill again for 5 more years until their historic meeting at Bill's home in November 1934. In his June 1966 Grapevine Memorial article for Ebbie, Bill also noted that he seldom saw him over the same period. When Ebbie's father died in mid-1929, he bequeathed $150,000 to each of his children, and that would be worth a little over $2 million today each. Much of Ebbie's inheritance was lost in the great stock market crash of October 1929. What remained was quickly squandered. Ebbie seemed to have a propensity for getting drunk and getting in trouble with the police. It was an increasing embarrassment to his brother John Boyd, who was then the mayor of Albany. As a consequence, Ebbie moved to Manchester, Vermont in the fall of 1932 and lived at the Bat and Kill Inn over the next year and a half. When the inn's proprietor passed away, Ebbie moved into the family summer home, which had been emptied and untended since his father's death. In the summer of 1934, Oxford Group members Sieber G. and Shep C. vacationed with Roland H. at his summer home in Glastonbury, Vermont. They decided to do some missionary work. Sieber knew Ebbie and had done some past drinking with him. Ebbie's drinking problem and pitiable situation became the focus of their discussions. Sieber suggested that they visit Ebbie, and he and Shep went to the Thatcher summer home in Manchester, but Roland did not join them. Ebbie was in a terrible and filthy condition amid a litter of trash and empty liquor bottles. After cleaning him up and getting him a meal, they informed Ebbie of the Oxford Group, but he was not quite ready yet to stop drinking. Ebbie's drinking led to serious run-ins with the Vermont police and incarceration. Vermont had an habitual drunk law which, after 3 arrests for intoxication, would result in a mandatory 6-month confinement to a prison or an institution. Ebbie was set to appear for a hearing in Bennington, Vermont, which could result in his commitment to the Brattleboro Retreat Asylum for the Insane. Sieber G., who earlier visited Ebbie, was a former state attorney and current state senator. The trial judge was his father, Collins. Sieber and Roland attended Ebbie's trial. Roland requested that Ebbie be released to his custody, and it was granted. Now, Ebbie might loosely be considered AA's first court referral. After his release, Ebbie stayed with Roland in his mansion-sized summer home. Roland explained the Oxford Group's principles to Ebbie and took him to Oxford Group meetings in nearby cities. Ebbie had the highest praise for Roland and recorded that he was well-versed in the Oxford Group's 4 absolutes of honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love, with emphasis on honesty. After several weeks in Vermont, Roland drove Ebbie to New York City, where he stayed with Shep C., waiting to become a resident at the Calvary Rescue Mission. Roland's Oxford Group service to Ebbie and the message he carried set an example of what AA would later call sponsorship. Ebbie, in turn, would do the same for Bill. Throughout his and Ebbie's life, Bill always referred to Ebbie as his sponsor. Ebbie was simply following the example set for him by Roland. Bill chronicled Ebbie's visit to his home in November 1934 as the central part of his finding sobriety. However, Bill and Ebbie have very differing accounts of the visit. Nearly half the narrative of the Big Book Chapter Bill story focuses on the visit. It also accounted for the largest change to the draft manuscript chapter. Uh-oh, I just lost the... That's nice. That's something I didn't want. Pardon me for a minute. Okay, one more time now. It also accounted for the largest change to the draft manuscript chapter. Bill wrote that Ebi, in a matter-of-fact way, told how two men had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. He had come to pass his experience along to me if I cared to have it. End of quote. The simple religious idea was for Bill to choose his own conception of God. The practical program of action evolved into a six-step recovery program used by early members up to the writing of the Big Book. In Bill's account of the visit, Ebi is living at the Calvary Rescue Mission, from which he calls Bill and visits that same afternoon. Bill greeted him when he arrived and was impressed by how well he looked. They sat at the kitchen table, and Bill offered Ebi a drink, which he declined. When asked what happened to him, Ebi said that he found sobriety with the help of the Oxford Group and was given a practical program of action, which Bill later called Ebi's formula. Bill claims that Ebi did not stay very long, and when Lois came home, he told her about the visit. In recorded talks, Ebi's account is completely different. He claimed that he was living with Shep C., and Lois answered the phone when he called. They set a date for dinner, and no one was home when he arrived, and he was greeted by a handyman named Green. Bill soon appeared, and they sat and talked, and Ebi claims that Bill did not drink openly and left the house twice to go on errands, but actually to sneak a drink. Lois arrived with a young woman who lived upstairs, and they all ate dinner and then moved to the living room, and Lois asked Ebi what happened to him, and he talked until 1 a.m., after which Bill walked him to the subway. In a separate account, Lois states that she arrived home to find Bill and Ebi together in the kitchen, and that Ebi made several visits, once staying for dinner. Now, given this, there's a possibility that Ebi is describing one of the later visits as if it was his first visit. I can't say for sure. The importance of Ebi's visit cannot be overstated. In an April 1958 talk to the New York City Medical Society on alcoholism, Bill recalled that, quote, Ebi sat across the kitchen table and enumerated the principles he learned from the Oxford Group that had sobered him up. The word-of-mouth program Ebi gave me was enlarged into what we now call AA's 12 Steps for Recovery. Bill also noted, the spark that was to become Alcoholics Anonymous had been struck. One alcoholic talking to another, making a deep identification with me, and bringing the principles of recovery within my reach. End quote. Following Ebi's visit to his home, Bill later checked himself into Towns Hospital for his fourth and last day on December 11, 1934, and that's Bill's sobriety date. Ebi visited Bill in the hospital and led him a second time through the Oxford Group principles that had sobered him up. Bill later fell into a deep depression and had a life-changing spiritual experience after crying out, quote, if there be a God, will he show himself? In Bill's story, he states, quote, God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Fearing that he had gone crazy, he called for Dr. Silkworth, who told him to hang on to what he had experienced because it seemed so much better than what he had just an hour ago. In AA Comes of Age, Bill wrote, quote, Ebi brought me a copy of William James's book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. It was difficult reading, but I devoured it. Spiritual experiences, James thought, could transform people. Some were sudden, others came very gradually, but nearly all had the great common denominator of deflation at depth, and that happened to me. Bill wrote, quote, Dr. Carl Jung told an Oxford Group friend of Ebi's how hopeless his alcoholism was, and Dr. Silkworth passed the same sentence upon me. Ebby, also an alcoholic, handed me the identical dose. On Dr. Silkworth's say-so alone, I would never have completely accepted the verdict. But when Ebby came along and one alcoholic began to talk to another, that clinched it. Bill concluded, quote, I envisioned the chain reaction among alcoholics, one carrying this message and these principles to the next. More than I could ever want, I now knew that I wanted to work with other alcoholics. As soon as I was discharged, I associated myself with the Oxford Group, and we worked at Calvary Mission and Towns Hospital. Bill's discharge date was December 18, 1934. He and his wife Lois, Ebby, and Shep C. attended weekly Oxford Group meetings at Calvary Hall in Calvary House. Alcoholic Oxford Group members also began meeting at Bill's home. Bill W. went to Akron, Ohio on a business trip in May 1935, and it quickly went sour. In poor spirits and tempted to enter the Mayflower Hotel bar, he realized he needed another alcoholic. He phoned clergy members listed on the hotel lobby directory, and he reached the Reverend Walter Tunks. Reverend Tunks referred Bill to Oxford Group member Norman Shepherd, who then referred Bill to Henrietta Seiberling. She had previously started an Oxford Group meeting to help Dr. Bob with his drinking problem. After meeting Bill at her home, she viewed his arrival as the answer to her prayers for Dr. Bob and called his wife Ann to arrange a dinner the next day. Bill met Dr. Bob on Mother's Day, May 12, 1935, at the gatehouse of the Seiberling Estate. Dr. Bob was so badly hungover that he planned to stay for only 15 minutes. Privately, Bill told him of his alcoholism based on his personal experience. Dr. Bob then opened up, and he and Bill talked until after 11 p.m. Dr. Bob's 15 minutes turned into 6 hours. Bill moved to Dr. Bob's house in early June at the invitation of Ann Smith. They all went to Oxford Group meetings at the home of T. Henry and Clarice Williams. In the spirit of what would later become Step 12 and Tradition 5, carrying a message to a still-suffering alcoholic is the primary and single purpose that gave birth to AA and its first group. Ebby T. carried a message to Bill W. in late 1934, and Bill carried a message to Dr. Bob in mid-1935. This led to the founding of AA on the day that Dr. Bob had his last drink. It's celebrated as June 10, 1935, but based on information known for some time, the date was very likely June 17th. In late June, Dr. Bob and Bill W. carried a message to Bill D. at Akron City Hospital, and he's called AA number 3. Akron's group number 1, which is recognized as AA's first group, marks its beginning as July 4, 1935, the date that Bill D. left the hospital. During the summer of 1935, Ebby was sober and living at the Calvary Rescue Mission. Roland H. took him on an extended trip to his Alamogordo, New Mexico ranch near his La Luz pottery factory. Ebby recalled that Roland had small Oxford Group meetings at his ranch house of people from neighboring farms and ranches. Ebby remembered that, quote, Roland set a great example. During my traveling with him, he gave me many things that were of great value. He had a thorough Oxford Group indoctrination and passed as much of it to me as he could. Bill W. returned to New York City in August or September 1935 and focused on getting the New York group organized. Meetings were held at Bill's home at 182 Clinton Street, which also became a halfway house of sorts. In December, Hank P., whose big book story is The Unbeliever, and Fitz M., whose big book story is Our Southern Friend, sobered up at Towns Hospital with Bill's help. And they are designated as AA number 1 and number 2 for New York, and they joined with Bill to form the New York group. In the following years, Hank started AA in New Jersey and had a major role in the publication of the Big Book. Fitz M. started AA in Washington, D.C., and helped start AA in Baltimore, Maryland. The Calvary Rescue Mission closed in 1936 after 10 years of operation. About 200,000 homeless men were helped by the mission. With its closing, Ebby moved in with Bill and Lois at 182 Clinton Street. Ebby returned to Albany in late 1936, and he went to work for the Ford Motor Company. In April 1937, he returned to drinking after 2.5 years of sobriety. Lois W., in her biography, Lois Remembers, wrote that this was one of the saddest days in her and Bill's life. Ebby began an on-again, off-again pattern of drinking and sobriety that would stay with him for the next 16 years. Ebby had a pattern of relying on others to get him out of trouble and providing him a place to live. He spent the summer of 1938 with Fitz M. and his family in Cumberton, Maryland, and they grew quite fond of him. He returned to New York and to drinking again in the fall and spent around 6 months in New Jersey at the Keswick Colony of Mercy for drunkards. He spent two winters there. Ebby was a very likable personality, and he used his charm and persuasion to obtain small handouts. There was something about him that persuaded people to want to help him. He was also quite skillful at panhandling. Ebby moved to Philadelphia in June 1940, and he was in terrible condition and sought help from the local AA members. They placed him in the Philadelphia General Hospital for the insane. He later held several jobs for short periods, but persistently drank himself out of work. During World War II, he worked for the Navy as a parts inspector in a Philadelphia repair facility. He was in his mid-40s and exempt from the draft, but his job allowed him to engage in work that was essential to the war effort, and he did quite well at it. He stayed sober through much of the war years, but was later fired for his drinking. He left Pennsylvania for New York in the fall of 1945 and moved in with Bill and Lois at Stepping Stones. He worked in the Grapevine Circulation Department for about a year. Predictably, Ebby started drinking again in 1946, and he was sent to Highwatch Farm in Kent, Connecticut. That summer, he went from being a patient to being the assistant manager of the farm under the direction of AA member Johnny S. In the fall, he was back living with Bill and Lois. 1947 was a repeat of 1946. Ebby spent nearly 2 years at Highwatch Farm, either as a patient or a staff member. Johnny S., a close friend of Bill W. and pioneer in the alcoholism treatment, attended the Yale School of Alcohol Studies and had managed several treatment centers. In the spring of 1948, he purchased a large manor house on Beech Hill above Dublin Lake in New Hampshire. They formed the Beech Hill Farm for the treatment of alcoholics. Ebby worked there for about a year until falling off the wagon again. Johnny S. noted that Ebby was a rather difficult patient and a difficult employee. By the late 1940s, Ebby became a homeless vagrant in the Bowery, which is the Skid Row section of New York City. His appearance was wretched, and he roamed the streets begging for handouts. He was in his mid-50s and on the verge of drinking himself to death. However, things would eventually turn better for Ebby, and the events that would lead to this began with the February 1948 Grapevine announcement that Bill W. and his wife Lois planned to tour large AA centers in the U.S. and Canada. Texas was among those centers. The Dallas Central office issued a notice that Bill and Lois would be visiting Texas on April 20th and 21st, and Bill chose Lubbock and Dallas as locations where groups in the area might gather to meet and talk with him. He was willing to talk at an open speaker meeting, but he also asked for a meeting of AA members only to discuss the traditions and a proposal for an annual conference of representatives, or what we today call the General Service Conference. A dinner reception was held for Bill at the Golden Pheasant Restaurant in Dallas. In the left image, he is sitting next to Esther E., whose big book story is The Flower of the South. She was responsible for getting AA started again in Dallas in 1943. Two future conference delegates were at the dinner. The man in the front leaning over the table is Olin L., and the man in the right image in the back row, second from the left, is Icky S. Most of the pioneer members who helped start AA in Dallas were at the dinner. Several of them later had a key role in helping Ebby. In July 1950, the historic First International Convention convened in Cleveland, Ohio, to vote on acceptance of the traditions. Prior to voting, six AA members each gave short talks on two of the proposed traditions. The first of these speakers was Olin L. of Texas. A very ill Dr. Bob made his last public appearance and farewell talk at the convention and sadly passed away the following November. Prior to his death, he and the other Alcoholic Foundation Board trustees approved a 5-year trial period for experimental conferences from 1951 to 1955, when it would be evaluated and a final decision made. In April 1951, 37 U.S. and Canadian delegates, which were half the planned number, convened in New York City for the first General Service Conference. As mentioned earlier, the Panel 1 delegates from Texas were Olin L. from Dallas and Icky S. from Houston. Icky later moved to Dallas and became the first Class B trustee from Texas in 1955. Olin and Icky virtually adopted Ebby when he later came to Dallas. Olin L. had an article published in the June 1951 Grapevine and revealed that he was a little over 5 years sober when selected as a delegate. From their first meeting in 1948, Olin and Bill W. would go on to form a very close friendship. Ebby T. would become the central link in that friendship. Bill W. visited Dallas again in early 1953. Olin L., Bert P., and Circe W. visited with him at the Melrose Hotel. Circe asked Bill, quote, "What would you wish to see happen more than anything else in AA?" And Bill replied that he'd like to see Ebby have a chance to get sober at Circe's clinic. This set a plan in action to bring Ebby to Dallas. The media challenge was how to find him and how to get him to agree to come to Texas. That task was given to Charlie M., a former Texas AA member who moved to New York City. Charlie made it known to New York members at Ebby's usual panhandling spots that he was trying to find Ebby for an opportunity to get him sober. In September 1953, he received a call from the Manhattan Central Office Secretary, Hazel R., who told him that Ebby was in the office seeking a handout. Charlie asked Hazel to keep him there. He met Ebby at the office and took him to a bar for some double shots of whiskey. Charlie encouraged Ebby to try to get sober in Texas with some of Charlie's AA friends there. He gave Ebby a $5 bill, which would be worth over $40 today, and promised him another $5 if they could meet the next day. He told Ebby that Bill W. more than anything wanted him to be sober. Ebby said he did not know about Texas, but he did want to get sober. Charlie M. phoned Olin L. and Circe W. to tell them of his contacting Ebby, and this was around the Labor Day holiday. Olin, Bert P., and Circe and William O. B. quickly pulled the money to buy Ebby an airplane ticket to Dallas. Olin and Circe met Ebby at the Love Field Airport. He complained that Charlie M. had promised to give him a pint of whiskey when he boarded the plane, but Charlie didn't give him any. Ebby was near complete collapse and immediately taken to Circe W.'s Texas clinic. He spent the next few months there. At first, there was no progress for several weeks, and his situation looked grim. However, after about 2 months, he improved and began attending meetings at the Dallas Suburban Group. Circe W. became Ebby's Texas sponsor and took him on a trip to Lubbock. Ebby made his first talk there. In November 1953, Olin L. worked to inform Bill that Ebby was much better thanks to the efforts of Circe and the clinic staff. He noted, quote, "Old Ebby acts like a man who wants to get well." Bill's reply thanked Olin, calling his letter the best news he's heard in years. And Bill expressed hope that Ebby was going to see daylight and at last nothing would make him happier. Ebby's brother John Boyd wrote to Olin on December 11th thanking him and saying how encouraged he was regarding Ebby's progress. Since 1951, while the General Service Conference was in its trial period, Bill W. declined most public speaking engagements. He made an exception for the 1954 Texas State Convention to express his gratitude for the help Ebby was receiving in Texas. In April, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram carried an article announcing Bill's plans to speak at the convention the following June. It was the first time the state convention was held in Fort Worth, and it ran from June 11th to 13th at the Hotel Texas. The hotel provided free coffee over the full event. Total attendance turned out to be twice that of any prior state convention. Bill's talk on the evening of June 12th took place prior to a $5 a plate banquet, and that would be $45 a plate banquet today, and a dance. The estimated attendance was over 700, and the master of ceremonies was Olin L. Bill was supposed to talk on the traditions, but instead he talked about how the Big Book was put together. And this talk is one of the most popular and widely circulated audio tapes and transcriptions among the AA membership to this day. Ebby also did a brief talk describing how he came to Texas. Bill's final talk, closing the convention, was at the Will Rogers Memorial Auditorium. His topic was the founding of AA. Estimated attendance was over 2,000, and the MC was Al B. During the state convention, a dinner was held for Bill at the Golden Pheasant Restaurant in Dallas. It was something of a reunion for those who attended the 1948 dinner. Some of them are shown in the photo. Starting with the lower left are William O.B., Joe M., and in the back are Circe W., Ebby T., Olin L., Bill W., and Al B., the owner of the restaurant. After his return home, Bill wrote to Olin to express his fond memories of the state convention and thanked him for his friendship. While in Fort Worth for the state convention, Ralph J. and his wife Mary Lee invited Ebby for a lengthy stay at their 7,000-acre Triangle J. Ranch in Ozona. Olin drove Ebby to the ranch in July, and he stayed for around 2 months. The image on the right shows a well-tanned Ebby and Ralph J. standing on a water tank for the livestock, which also served as a swimming pool. Ralph J. was a Pioneer Texas AA member, and his wife Mary Lee an early member of Al-Anon family groups. They often hosted barbecues and outdoor speaker meetings at their ranch. Ralph, Mary Lee, and Ebby also attended open meetings together in San Angelo. Meeting logs for July and August 1954 show Ebby chairing some of them. Ranch life agreed with Ebby, and he soon fitted in as a ranch hand, participating in roundups, sheep shearing, and other ranch work. On August 6, 1954, he sent a cheerful letter to Olin L. describing some of his activities. They included dove hunting, his first sight of a rattlesnake, horseback riding and almost falling off, and swimming every day and getting sunburn. He noted that he had the opportunity to speak at meetings in Sonora and San Angelo. And he closed with saying, quote, "How much better off than a year ago at this time, thanks to you, Circe, Icky, and many others." Ebby wrote again to Olin in September 1954 that he planned to return to Dallas after Labor Day. He noted that Labor Day reminded him of his arrival in Dallas the previous year and all that Olin and Circe and many others did for him. He closed with saying, "How I will ever be able to repay all of you is a tough question, but maybe I can get back at you in some small part. I have it always in mind, and I am grateful." But Ebby, being Ebby, after returning to Dallas, also returned to drinking in late 1954. He was 13 months sober at the time. Following this, he stayed sober for around 7 years, and that was his longest period of sobriety in AA. He also held the same job for several years, which was a remarkable achievement in view of his past. Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, began as an experiment in 1947 for retrieving crude oil. In March 1949, Halliburton Oil Company performed the first two commercial hydraulic fracturing treatments in Oklahoma and Texas. In April 1955, Ebby wrote to Bill W. on a hydraulic fracking proposal, which was a 1,000-acre field in Oklahoma, to see if Bill or any of his old Wall Street friends would be interested in investing. Bill quickly replied that he had no wish to get involved, and he turned down the offer. Bill wrote to Ebby in early 1955, telling him of the excitement building in anticipation of the International Convention in St. Louis. Bill noted, quote, "There will never be another one like it," and he invited Ebby to attend as his guest, all expenses paid. Ebby received special recognition while there, and the image on the right shows him and Bill at the convention. Ebby became a popular figure at the Suburban Club in Dallas and in demand as a speaker at large AA meetings. For most of his life, he had the notion that he could find happiness if he could just find the right woman and the right job to support them both. In 1957, he met Chloe Kay, a former nurse at Circe W.'s clinic. Circe had to fire her because of her pill habit. Ebby told a number of people that Chloe was the great love of his life. She may have looked to Ebby to provide care and support because she was quite ill. As her illness progressed, her demands on Ebby increased. He was her caretaker, but he had all he could do to take care of himself. Ebby was Bill's special guest again for the 1960 International Convention in Long Beach, California. He now had 6 years of sobriety and was looked upon as a successful AA member. Life appeared to be good for him, but he was in poor health, and 1961 would turn out to be a disastrous year. Ebby's girlfriend, Chloe, died on September 28, 1961, and he started drinking again the next day. He was around 7 years sober, and like Chloe, he also had a problem with pills. Bill sent his condolences, and he invited Ebby to phone him, collect, and come immediately to Stepping Stones. Ebby returned to New York, and he stayed with Bill and Lois. On October 11th, Bill wrote to Olin that, quote, "People were awfully glad to see Ebby at the annual dinner here at the house, and he seemed to be in good form, his recent tragedy notwithstanding. He has gone up to see his brother in Albany, but I expect to see him before he starts back to Dallas. We had a hell of a good visit with him here." Shortly after his return to Dallas in December 1961, Ebby was hospitalized with pneumonia for almost 2 weeks and then transferred to the Texas Clinic for convalescence. The clinic was no longer operated by Circe W. Ebby's poor health left him unable to work or support himself. His sole income was a small monthly Social Security check. Bill set about organizing the, quote, "Thatcher Fund" of private donations to help Ebby financially. Bill asked Icky S. to arrange for Ebby's return to New York, and he was discharged from the clinic on December 27th and flew to New York the same day, destitute and suffering from emphysema. Bill met him at the airport and took him to Stepping Stones for several days. Ebby moved into his brother Ken's home in Del Mar, New York in January 1962. Shortly after arriving, he wrote letters to two AA friends, Emery and Witt, describing his illness of the previous December and his relocation to New York. At Bill's request, the General Service Board reported to the 1962 conference that it had approved a monthly grant to Ebby of $200, which would be the equivalent of $1,500 today. In July, Ebby wrote to Ralph and Mary Lee J. at Ozona, Texas, that he and Bill took a trip to Manchester, Vermont. He noted that, quote, "It was 50 years ago this coming fall that we were in school together there." Ebby also noted that when he left their ranch, he weighed about 170 pounds and had since fallen to around 120. The 1963 conference approved the board action of a special monthly grant to Ebby of $200. The conference advisory action cited him as, quote, "the man who helped co-founder Bill W. achieve sobriety and who was indirectly responsible for creation of the AA Fellowship." In October 1963, Ebby was a guest at Bill's annual dinner in Manhattan and introduced as Bill's sponsor. However, Ebby seemed sad and his health was seriously declining. That winter, he moved to Chit Chat Farms, Pennsylvania. After he moved out of his brother Ken's home, they found 30 empty vodka bottles stashed around the house. In early 1964, Ebby was moved to High Watch Farm in Kent, Connecticut, and Bill later asked Margaret McPike, a registered nurse, if Ebby could stay at the McPike Farm in Galway, New York, managed by her and her husband, Mickey. Bill hoped that Ebby would do much better there. Margaret agreed, and Ebby was moved to the farm on May 30th. The photo on the left was taken on the day of his arrival. Bill wrote to Olin in July that Ebby, quote, "has scarcely the energy to talk to anyone." And he closed by saying, quote, "I recall with gratitude everything you and many AAs in Texas did in the days gone by to make Ebby better and happier than he had ever been before." Ebby was regularly visited at the McPike Farm by Bill W. and various AA members, but his declining health led to a stroke and hospitalization for intensive care. He died in the hospital on March 21, 1966, at age 70 and 2.5 years sober. Bill and Lois were in Mexico, but quickly returned for Ebby's wake and funeral. Special tributes to the passing of Ebby, Dr. Harry Tebow, and Sister Ignatia were delivered by Bill at the opening of the 1966 conference. Memorials for Ebby appeared in the June 1966 Grapevine and AA Exchange Bulletin. Ebby was laid to rest in the family plot at Albany in rural... Good Lord, this... I'm sorry I got involved with that thing with the... Ebby was laid to rest in the family plot at Albany Rural Cemetery. The cemetery's webpage carried a brief biography for each gravesite. Ebby's read, quote, "He was credited by Bill Wilson for being Wilson's sponsor in an alcohol remediation program. Wilson went on to become the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous." In regard to the first member and first group in New York, Ebby T. has an awkward place in the popular history of AA. In a way, it's a case that he's there, but also like he's not there and forgotten. Roland Hazard, who couldn't stay sober, is part of an episode defined in AA history as, quote, first in the chain of events that led to the founding of AA. But Ebby doesn't even rise to the level of second, third, or fourth in that chain of events. And why is Bill's visit with Dr. Bob in mid-1935 considered the founding of AA, as opposed to Ebby's visit with Bill in November and December of 1934? Why is the hospital discharge date of Bill D considered the founding of AA's first group and not the hospital discharge date of Bill W 7 months earlier? They did have meetings at Bill's home. And why is Bill D considered AA number 3 and Ernie G, who couldn't stay sober, considered AA number 4? Three members preceded them both, Ebby, Bill, and Dr. Bob, in that order. Ebby doesn't even get a token AA number 1 or AA number 2 in New York. Hank P, who couldn't stay sober, and Fitz M are usually called AA number 1 and number 2 in New York. An explanation of why Ebby was not considered a founder of AA can be found in an excellent history book written in 1979. Its author was a very capable eyewitness diarist and as close to Bill W. as you can get. The book is part of Al-Anon's Family Group conference-approved literature. Lois W. knew Ebby since childhood, and with some apprehension, she wrote in her 1979 autobiography, Lois Remembers, stating, "I feel disloyal in writing these notes about Ebby, but it's important that future generations of AAs know why Ebby was never considered a founder of AA." And she listed four reasons. First, Bill wanted sobriety with his whole soul, and Ebby appeared to want just enough to stay out of trouble. Second, beyond his visit with Bill, Ebby seemed to do little about helping others. He never appeared to be an active member of AA. And third, after his first slip, harmful thoughts seemed to possess him. He appeared jealous of Bill and critical, even when sober, of both the Oxford group and AA. And fourth, Ebby carried a message to Bill, but he never followed up with the action to help AA grow in its infancy. All the same, Ebby certainly deserves a respected place in AA history. He was not considered a founder, but he was a pathfinder. He was AA's first member to carry a message of recovery to a still-suffering alcoholic. By Bill W.'s own admission, Ebby was AA's first sponsor. Bill also chronicled that Ebby gave him the basic spiritual principles that became AA's program of recovery. The word benefactor means someone who gives, and Ebby, in Bill's own words, gave him a, quote, practical program of action that worked. Bill called it Ebby's formula. Today we call it the 12 steps. Without Ebby carrying a message to Bill in November 1934, AA would not exist today. In a June 1966 Grapevine Memorial article for Ebby, Bill wrote, quote, "In his 70th year and on the 21st of March, my friend and sponsor, Ebby, passed beyond our sight and hearing. Ebby had been enabled to bring me the gift of grace because he could reach me at depth through the language of the heart. He had pushed ajar that great gate through which all in AA have since passed to find their freedom under God. It's probably safe to say that when Bill W. and Dr. Bob first met in Akron, they had no idea at all of the fellowship of alcoholics that would evolve from their humble meeting and how it would save the lives of millions of alcoholics over the following years. That 1935 meeting between Bill and Dr. Bob happened because of a 1934 meeting between Bill and Ebby. And that concludes the presentation. I hope you found it informative and entertaining. Thank you for the opportunity today.